Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. The UN says a new citizenship law in India is fundamentally discriminatory against Muslims, and people are taking to the streets to voice their anger.
It's against the Muslims. It's against the secular ideas of India. And that's the very basic idea of India, to stand on secularism.
Also today, President Trump says we've got an amazing trade deal with China, but Trump's trade wars are far from over.
The average U.S. tariff generally is at a 25-year high.
And almost 100 years ago, women in America won the right to vote. Their path was paved by women down under.
As one person at the time commented, the world fairly stood aghast to see the improvements that were going on in Australia.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it today. We start in India, the world's largest democracy. Under the Indian Constitution, all people are created equal. But now, because of a new citizenship and immigration law, non-Muslims seem more equal than Muslims. Protests against the law are continuing in major cities across India. Bhumika Saraswati said she and her fellow students would not be intimidated despite police violence over the weekend.
I just want to make it clear, nobody is scared. Like, people in Hong Kong are protesting, Chile are protesting, and they are not scared. We are not scared too.
The United Nations says India's new law discriminates against Muslims. Sri Kumar is a student who is out protesting in Delhi today.
It's against the Muslims. It's against the ethos of India. It's against the secular ideas of India. And that's the very basic idea of India, to stand on secularism.
Davina Gupta is in Delhi. She's host of the BBC program Work Life India.
There are thousands of students who are out in the streets. Most of them are shouting Azadi, Azadi, which means freedom, freedom. And it's sort of a spark that's spreading across India. We've seen at least 9 cities across northern, eastern and western India where students from various universities have taken out similar march in solidarity with the Delhi students. And it is also acting like a glue to unite the opposition leaders. We saw the opposition leaders now stepping out on the streets with the students, one of them being Priyanka Gandhi from the Congress Party and member of the Gandhi dynasty. And she said there's been an attack on the Indian secular fabric. We just want to save our constitution and we will be here till the time it requires.
Who are the demonstrators? Is it a mix of Muslim and non-Muslim students?
Yes, and that's been the central point of these protests, Marco, because it's gone beyond the religious lines for the young demographic in India. We've seen protest solidarity march around different universities in India, regardless of the religion of students. It's sort of as if the young are now showing the way to the politicians that division along the religious lines is not what they favor. It's a very strong message. And I must say, it's taken the Hindu Nationalist Party, which is in power at the moment, by surprise. They've traditionally banked on a Hindu vote base. 80% of population in India is a Hindu population. There are nearly 170 million Muslims in the country. And the Hindu Nationalist Party has never shied away from taking out strong and bold laws which have been seen favoring Hindu religion over others. And this is where, as they say, the last straw on the camel's back, because we have seen these students coming out with placards, shouting slogans, taking out candlelight vigils, also shouting outside police stations where some of their friends had been detained. And they are not from any particular community.
Of course, Narendra Modi leads the BJP, which is an openly Hindu nationalist party, and that explains some of this. But what is driving his agenda? Like, what's motivating him right now?
Well, critics say, Marco, that right now the party is trying to consolidate its base across the country, and it knows that its base is Hindu voters. The critics are saying that this is a diversionary tactic, taking away the conversation from the falling growth, which is slowest in 6 years, high malnutrition, high unemployment, which is around 4-decade high. And the critics believe that this vote bank politics tactic is to take away the main question of falling economy and rising food prices.
So a nationalist move to kind of distract from a lagging economy. What are the wider concerns about where this could all lead?
As you rightly mentioned, the United Nations Human Rights Office has issued a statement saying that this particular act is discriminatory. It's leading to a very disturbing scenario, one where you would have the secular fabric of the country being defended on one hand by the students, and on the other hand, the government is refusing to back off. Right now, we're seeing that this could be a sign of a dangerous time. People are questioning whether it is against the 170 million Muslims who are in the country. The government, though, says that it's not against any Indian. There still are a government elected for all the Indians, including the Muslims. But those words need stronger action if India needs to go into 2020 as a democratic and a secular country.
Devina Gupta, host of the BBC program Work Life India, speaking with us from Delhi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Negotiators worked overtime on the planet's climate crisis this weekend. The UN climate talks in Madrid dragged on for 2 extra days past the original Friday deadline. But even with the extra time, countries could not agree on much. Disappointment is the word used by many to describe the summit. Reporter Rachel Waldholtz was in Madrid for us. So we know the news isn't great, Rachel, but what exactly happened over the weekend?
Yeah, Marco, I think the final result was actually worse than most people expected. Diplomats generally try to put a good face on these things, but when you have the UN Secretary General, who's been a real cheerleader for these talks, tweeting that he's disappointed in the result, then you really know that nobody is happy. There was one big technical issue that they were trying to solve. That was to set up rules for international carbon markets, and that's been a huge difficult issue for these talks. It took them into overtime last year. They couldn't come to an agreement. They postponed it. And so this year, same thing happened. Couldn't come to an agreement, postponed it till next year. But the bigger picture goal of these talks was really to build momentum going into 2020, because next year is when countries are supposed to come forward with new targets to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. And on that front, they also didn't really succeed. Most of the world's biggest emitters have not given any signal that they intend to follow through on that. They have not committed to submitting new targets. So on that front, I think a lot of people left here, like the Secretary General, really disappointed.
Yeah, and next year the U.S. will officially not be in the agreement anymore. And there was concern about what role the U.S. would play going into Madrid now that the Trump administration is formally withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. How much is the U.S. to blame for the lack of progress?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a certain amount of blame for the U.S. I mean, there was a lot of frustration with the U.S. all throughout these negotiations. And, you know, for two reasons. First, there was frustration at the absence of U.S. leadership, that the U.S. could have been playing a major role in rallying other countries to step up. But also, other countries said its presence was a problem. There was really a sense of, you know, okay, you're leaving, so leave, but don't block progress for everyone else on your way out the door. And some countries said that's exactly what the U.S. was doing, especially on the issue of finance for countries that need help dealing with the impacts of climate change. And you saw some of that frustration really spill into public view on Sunday. That's when Ian Fry, who was representing the Pacific Island nation of Tuvalu, he said the U.S. is trying to avoid its responsibility to help nations that are vulnerable to climate change.
If they get their way, they will wash their hands of any actions to assist countries which have been affected by the impacts of climate change. This is an absolute tragedy and a travesty.
And he went on to say that millions of people are already being impacted by climate change all over the world.
Denying this fact could be interpreted by some to be a crime against humanity. Thank you.
Wow, strong words. And I feel a finger pointed right at the United States. Was it just the U.S. blocking progress at the talks in Madrid, or were other countries as well?
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't just the U.S. China and India also were seen as being reluctant to step up their commitments next year, at least unless other wealthier countries step up first. And on the issue of carbon markets, it was Brazil and Australia that were holding out for rules that other countries said would essentially undermine the Paris Agreement if they were agreed to.
So, Rachel, what happens next?
That is such a good question. Next year will be the real test for this international climate process. That's when countries are supposed to come forward with these new targets. And there was some silver lining for activists. The EU, for instance, has set a new target to become climate neutral by 2050, and advocates hope other countries might follow suit. But I think attention now really shifts back inside countries to domestic politics, where advocates will be pushing countries to step up and come forward with new commitments.
Rachel Waldholz, fresh from the UN Climate Summit in Madrid. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Marco.
Good news for all you gift givers who have not finished your holiday shopping yet. President Trump canceled tariffs on imports of Chinese consumer products. Those were set to take effect yesterday and would have made imported toys, electronics, clothes a bit more expensive for American shoppers. President Trump hailed the first phase of a trade agreement with China as an amazing deal for all. Economist Katie Russ at the University of California, Davis, has been following the U.S.-China trade war. She also writes for Econofact, a network of economists that break down complicated issues for the rest of us. So it seemed more details came out over the weekend on this deal. Would you say this is a win, or are we just back to where we started before the trade war?
It's hard to tell. On the one hand, we see that the tariffs that have been put in place on Chinese goods, they still are in place. Some of them have been reduced to 7.5% from 15%. Others still remain at higher levels. So in terms of the tariffs and the cost that they are putting on production chains and so forth, that's still in place. On the other hand, there are these really interesting provisions where China's agreeing to roughly double their purchases of U.S. goods. So that includes agricultural goods, manufactured goods, energy-related products. That is something new and different. They've also, according to the United States Trade Representative fact sheet, they've apparently agreed to some market opening for financial and other services. And they've agreed to stop some practices that increase the likelihood proprietary technologies might get swiped.
U.S. farmers have been hit pretty hard in the trade war. Is the deal going to cover the losses they faced in the last 2 years, or they kind of have to just go forward from here?
So it's a very complicated situation in that we've already seen bankruptcies for farmers spike. So we've already seen quite a bit of pressure in the agricultural sector, even though there's been substantial aid offered through USDA programs. So it seems that there's been some damage done that's hard to repair. China may have agreed. Again, it's hard to tell because the details are still forthcoming. We haven't seen the final agreement. But it does look like China may approximately double its purchases of agricultural goods from the United States, especially for grains.
I mean, there has been damage in many sectors. How has this all affected U.S. consumers?
It's hard to see because there's been a lot of juice in the economy from expansionary tax cuts from the 2017 Tax Reform Act. But what we see for consumers, one study showed the costs of the tariff pretty much wipe out the benefits from the tax cut for the vast majority of households. For the economy as a whole, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors estimated tariffs and trade uncertainty surrounding these new policies have reduced U.S. GDP 1% lower than it would have been without the trade war. And that's just through the first half of 2019.
And Katie, do you have any idea how the Chinese government sees this trade deal? Can we expect a de-escalation from both Washington and Beijing at this point?
It's hard to say. I think they have some pressures on them also to not lose face with their public, like they're giving too much to the U.S. At the same time, they really want to get this over with. The average tariff on Chinese goods is more than 20% right now. So for China, they may have gained something in that there seems to be more of a willingness to come to the table and not just cause pain.
This is said to be phase one of this trade deal that was arrived at. How likely is it we'll reach phase two and three? Is it the monumental breakthrough that Trump claims?
So here I can only speak speculatively. There have been a lot of rumors going around that there would be no additional deals until after the election. With domestic political pressures at home, it might get sped up. It's really hard to tell what a phase two might look like. It's hard to tell whether phase one will actually work out. There may be what they call snapback provisions in this phase one deal. That would mean that should the United States determine that China isn't doing what China said it would, that the tariffs would just go back up to 15%, and then, you know, everything would start all over again.
Economist Katie Russ at UC Davis, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. It's a pleasure.
Coming up on the show, Chileans are taking all their protest energy and using it to write a new constitution. You're with The World. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Exactly 2 months ago, protests erupted across Chile. It started with students demonstrating against a subway fare hike, but it quickly grew into something much, much bigger. Most of the demonstrations were peaceful, but there was also vandalism.
He decretado estado de emergencia en las provincias de
President
Santiago,
Sebastián Piñera ordered the military to the streets in late October and issued a curfew in the nation's capital, Santiago. But protests and crackdowns are not the whole story. The government agreed to a big demand from protesters, a new constitution to replace the one that goes back decades to the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. And Chileans are serious about making the new constitution fit their vision for a democratic Chile. That's what Catalina May tells me. She hosts the Spanish-language podcast Las Raras in Santiago.
In a very spontaneous way, people started gathering, like getting together, meeting in parks and squares and universities and social centers.
Tell me a little bit about the mood in some of these assemblies.
Yeah, this created a very nice sense of community, and all kinds of things started happening. Like, for example, we recorded these musicians. They were volunteers, and they gathered in this small square in a neighborhood in the center of Santiago, and they played, for example, this song from Víctor Jara. He was a very important and popular songwriter who was killed during the first days of Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship.
And what were they doing in these squares, in these gatherings?
They were basically trying to figure out what are the demands of the social movement, because there is no leadership. So these meetings, these spontaneous meetings, started to become assemblies. And the conversation started to get more serious. And among all the demands, one became very quickly a priority. And that was a change of the constitution.
So what is it about the Chilean constitution and changing it that is so important to the people of Chile?
Yeah, it's very important because Chilean constitution was imposed during Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. They killed and tortured and disappeared thousands of people. And they also transformed the country in what it is now, a very unequal and unfair society.
So next April, with this vote, what exactly will people be voting on?
So what we're voting is, we're having two questions. If we want to change the constitution, and what kind of body should write the new constitution? And this is very important because the social movement is demanding to be part of this process of writing the new constitution.
And the demands emerge from these assemblies that seem to happen almost spontaneously in parks and venues across Santiago. I want to know more about these assemblies. What are they really about, and who's been going to them?
They are very, very interesting. They are self-organized. For example, different groups of neighbors organize some of them, or people with shared interest. With my podcast Las Raras, we have been recording in lots of them. We went, for example, to one who was organized by feminist journalists.
A mí me ha gustado mucho este proceso de participación porque siento que ha sido un espacio de reflexión.
There, I met a journalist. Her name was Constanza Pérez.
And what is she saying, Catalina?
She told me that she's loving this process of participating because it has been a space to meet and reflect with people she wouldn't have met otherwise. We went to another one who was organized by countrymen who traveled to Santiago to meet here. We even went to one for kids in a museum.
Hola.
What's very interesting as well is that now that we know that the constitution is going to be changed, people are really, really getting into understanding this. That is why, for example, nowadays, constitutional lawyers in Chile are like rock stars. Like they are giving talks everywhere and hundreds of people are meeting to listen to them.
Fernando.
Muchas gracias.
I, for example, went to one assembly in which there was this constitutional lawyer called Fernando Atria. He has been fighting to change the constitution for years, and 500 people were there. It was a small square. It was crowded.
Yo nunca había visto un hambre por entender el problema constitucional.
Catalina, what's happening here?
Yeah, Fernando Atria is saying that he has never seen a hunger so strong for understanding the constitutional problem, he says, as what he's seeing today. So he is giving like 3 talks a day, traveling all along the country, and he's not the only one. There are many constitutional lawyers who are doing the same.
When you go to one of these assemblies, what are they actually doing?
I went to one in which they made a really interesting exercise.
Bueno, lo que nosotros, una de las metodologías que hemos presentado es un simulacro de asamblea constituyente, el cual es un experimento.
It was led by law students of Universidad de Chile, and they were like 150 people, I would say.
Número 4, y hacemos grupos de 15 personas.
Yes.
Número 6 por aquí, número 6.
So they were separating into groups, divided by numbers, and the goal was to talk about which rights should be included in the new constitution.
I mean, what you're describing takes me back to like the constitutional convention here in the United States where people are sitting around and talking about what the future is supposed to be. I mean, how historic is this moment for Chileans, for most Chileans?
That's really the feeling now. It's huge. It's very important for us. But sadly, we can't celebrate as we would like because the repression during these 8 weeks have been terrible. 5 people have been killed, 352 people have been shot by the police in their eyes, and thousands have been injured, tortured, and sexually abused by state agents. And that is why, for example, this volunteer group of musicians who were performing in this square of a neighborhood that we heard before, also perform Mozart's Requiem.
When those musicians are performing, what's the feeling? What's the ambience in the square?
Lots of respect for the victims, and also we're hurting. So we would like to celebrate this win of the social movement, but it's not the moment.
Catalina, are you confident this vote is going to happen, that you will have a new constitution and a new way forward in Chile come April?
I do. The right-wing parties are trying to block everything, so it's very hard to move forward. But I really believe in the power of this social movement, and I believe in people, and I believe that they want to build a better country.
Catalina May, host of the Spanish-language podcast Las Raras, or The Outsiders, speaking with us from Santiago, Chile. Thank you very much, Catalina. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you, Marco.
The United Nations says Chilean authorities have violated human rights in quelling the demonstrations. Catalina mentioned the casualties during the protests this past fall. The numbers after 2 months of protests, 26 people have died, many more injured, and 28,000 people detained. You're listening to The World. The Senate passed a resolution recognizing Turkey's genocide of the Armenian people. Some say it's a sign that President Trump's policy with Turkey is failing.
The more President Trump is seen like he's giving Turkey a free pass, the more pressure we see coming from the Congress.
Tense times between Ankara and Washington. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. As we head into 2020, you're going to be hearing a lot more about women's suffrage. That's because next year will mark 100 years since American women gained the right to vote. Women fought hard for that right, but they were not alone. They were part of a global movement that began in Australia 125 years ago this month. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy with the story.
It all started in the late 1800s. Women around the world were organizing for rights. In the British colony of New Zealand, women won the right to vote through a combination of petition drives and male allies in leadership. A year later, one of the neighboring colonies in Australia took it a step further, giving women the right to vote and to hold office.
It's not by strategy or stealth that gets through. It's actually by accident.
Claire Wright is an Australian professor who has written books about this. She says the women's movement in the colony of South Australia got a bill for women's suffrage introduced. A conservative lawmaker tried to squash the bill by expanding it to also give women the right to hold office.
And he thinks that this is what will sink the bill, because nobody is asking for that.
But he's wrong. His plan fails. And the bill passes. It gives women an opening to fight for much more. The colonies were in the process of coming together to create Australia. And Wright says South Australia's representatives insisted they'd only join the new country if women kept their voting rights.
So effectively, women's suffrage is made the precondition to a federated Australia, to this whole process of nation building. And so that's what happens.
It attracted the attention of the world. Wright says sociologists and journalists flocked to Australia to see if the critics of suffrage were right, that it would destroy families because women wouldn't want to get married anymore or have babies. They found a country passing sweeping social reforms like pension programs, regulations on working conditions, and a mandated living wage.
As one person at the time, a journalist commented, the world fairly stood aghast to see the improvements that were going on in Australia.
A leader of Australia's suffrage movement, Vita Goldstein, was part of a global community of women activists working for suffrage. She set out on a world tour.
Everybody wanted to hear what she had to say. Everybody wanted to see this famous woman. It was like she was a unicorn.
The major U.S. newspapers reported on her lectures and travels. President Theodore Roosevelt even invited her to the Oval Office.
Because, in his words, he wanted to see what one of these enfranchised women looked like. And he was very pleased to see that she had retained all of her feminine charms.
And that's how Australian women played a key role in helping turn a global tide. Wright says the country's history as the spark for women's suffrage has been largely forgotten, even in Australia, because, Wright says, it was overshadowed by World War I and male mythologies that rose up around it. But as countries mark their 100th anniversaries of women's suffrage, Australia's role is being remembered, along with the people those events left behind.
I'm somebody who asks this question. What is the purpose in marking the anniversaries of women's suffrage?
Martha Jones is a professor of history at Johns Hopkins. She points out that after the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gave women the right to vote in 1920, non-white women went to the polls and were turned away. Similarly, the Australian law that granted women the right to vote 25 years earlier didn't include Indigenous women.
I think it's difficult to reach back, particularly to the 19th century, to those philosophies, those theories, those tactics, and hold them up as worthy of veneration in the 21st century.
But at least the suffrage anniversaries can remind people of what women across the world can achieve together, says Catherine Marino, an assistant professor of women's history at UCLA.
It's important to remember that it was a movement that didn't have widespread support in the United States or in many countries. And it was really only because of international support, dialogue, collaboration, exchange of ideas, inspiration, and solidarity that suffrage passed and was adopted.
For Claire Wright in Australia, which named its first female prime minister, Julia Gillard, in 2010, she hopes the 125th anniversary will remind her country what it can achieve.
Radical change in a peaceful way. If we could understand ourselves as a country that had pioneered that sort of response to global issues, well,
maybe Australia could surprise the world again. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Turkey's government is angry with Washington after a unanimous vote in the U.S. Senate last week recognizing the 1915 Armenian genocide. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan now says the Turkish parliament may adopt its own measure and recognize the killing of Native Americans by European settlers as genocide.
He's just merely appropriating the suffering of all of our ancestors merely to further genocide denial in Turkey.
That's Native American attorney Brett Chapman. He's not impressed with the Turkish leader's action.
He's just mentioning us, citing us in an insincere way so he can lash back out at the United States government.
The Turkish president has also threatened to close an airbase that houses U.S. nuclear warheads. I asked Gonul Tol, the director of the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies, whether Erdogan's threat was bluster.
Obviously, anything is possible. He is the guy who calls the shots in the country. He is furious. He has been upset about congressional measures, and he's been upset about threat of sanctions. And the relationship between Turkey and the United States has been going through one of its worst periods in the history of the relationship. So he is clearly frustrated. And he can shut down both the Incirlik Air Base, which is hosting U.S. nuclear warheads, and he could also shut down the Kürecik radar base. But I think if he does that, that would be a strategic mistake, because that would be the nuclear option, because Turkey does not have much leverage over the United States. And those air bases are about the only leverage that Turkey holds.
Well, Erdogan and Turkey's relations with Russia are increasingly cozy. And in October, Erdogan sat down with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, for 5 hours of talks. I gather for the most part they discussed the conflict in northern Syria, but 5 straight hours suggests they didn't want to break up the conversation. What is that relationship like, the relationship between Erdogan and Putin?
Well, Erdogan and Putin are certainly cultivated closer defense ties, but I think that relationship is still very fragile. Because if you look at all the areas surrounding these countries, the Balkans, the Caucasus, the Middle East, even in North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean, which is a very important region for Turkey and Turkish national interests, you see major policy divergences. These two countries do not see eye to eye on any of these regions, and particularly concerning to Turkey is the Black Sea region. Since 2014, after the annexation of Crimea, Russia has changed the balance of power in its own favor. So Turkey is very concerned about that. So I think this relationship is still very fragile, and that's why I believe that a step like closing down the air bases in Turkey would be the last resort, given how Turkey feels threatened vis-a-vis Russia in places like the Black Sea and in Syria.
Gonul, despite the measure on Armenian genocide in Congress, President Trump considers Erdogan a friend and an ally. Does that relationship have a future?
Obviously, we have to see in 2020. If he gets elected, certainly President Trump is about the only friend that President Erdogan has in Washington. And so far, it has paid off. President Erdogan put all his eggs in Trump's basket, and President Trump did everything he can to put brakes on congressional efforts to slap more sanctions to punish Turkey. But the problem there is, the more President Trump is seen like he's giving Turkey a free pass, the more pressure we see coming from the Congress on President Trump to do more, to punish Turkey. So the issue of Turkey has now become a matter of domestic politics. Mm. And I think that's why it's become a dangerous relationship, the relationship between President Trump and President Erdogan, because the more close they get, the angrier the Congress becomes. And that's not good news for the future of U.S.-Turkey relations, especially when we consider the upcoming elections in 2020 if President Trump doesn't get elected, but also President Erdogan is also losing ground.
Gonul, help us understand why Turkey is so adamant about denying the Armenian genocide. I mean, the modern Turkish state did not exist then. And you look at Germany, Germany's owned its role in the Holocaust. How do you explain it?
It goes to the heart of Turkey's nation building process. If Turkey recognizes the Armenian genocide, Turkey is afraid of demands by Armenians, territorial demands particularly. Nationalism is on the rise in Turkey, and President Erdogan has built his entire political survival strategy on nationalism. And because of that nationalism, it's really difficult to recognize Armenian genocide.
Gonul Tol directs the Middle East Institute Center for Turkish Studies. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This weekend in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, tragedy with deep medical implications. Officials reported that members of the rebel group, the Allied Democratic Forces, killed nearly 24 people in the regional capital of Beni. A local human rights group says that since October, rebel groups have killed more than 150 people. And the worsening security is also complicating efforts to curb another deadly threat, the spread of Ebola. David Gressley is the Ebola Response Coordinator for the United Nations in DR Congo. What is driving these recent killings, David? What do the rebel groups actually want?
Well, the Allied Defense Forces is a very specific group, which is significantly different than others. It's a Ugandan-led group that has been present in the DRC since the time of President Mobutu, more than 2 decades ago. And they are very present on the outside edges of Beni and into the forest of the Virunga National Park. They typically will carry out reprisal attacks when they're under military pressure, and that's exactly what happened this time. What's ironic is they don't actually attack Ebola responders directly, but the Ebola response is often suspended because of the attacks. But also when people protest out of frustration from these massacres, that can also suspend a lot of the action against Ebola.
I have heard, though, that Ebola responders and doctors have been targets. Rebels attacked health facilities last month, and 4 responders were killed and 5 others were injured.
That is correct, but it's not the Allied Defense Forces. These are local groups that are carrying these attacks out, and this frankly seems to have more of a criminal intent than just a normal conflict environment. And so it's actually quite difficult when you are actually the target yourself. It's different than trying to avoid getting caught up in a conflict between 2 armed groups. So we have to assume that those attacks will continue. It's very troubling.
What can you do to ensure their safety?
So what we have done is we've requested both the Congolese Army and National Police, together with the UN peacekeeping force, to forward deploy into those areas with existing transmission to provide the kind of security that allows the response to go forward. We've also set up about a week ago an air bridge, which allows people to move into these sensitive areas during the day, do their work, vaccination, working with communities, and then returning and spending the night elsewhere to be in more security.
Mm.
I think the number one thing I'd really like to highlight is that even with all the violence that we saw around Beni, that response continued. There were a number of people from the international community that left, but those who came from the community continued to work, despite the kind of disruptions that this violence provided. So I think it's the local heroes that we have to recognize.
I know the UN peacekeeping mission has heard the frustration from communities that are in the thick of this violence. You're also with the UN. You're not a peacekeeper, but are you also hearing some of the frustration from locals, David?
Yes, absolutely. I've heard those frustrations. I mean, the frustrations are real. The number of people who've been killed is intended to terrorize the way people are killed by machete, basically. And it's horrific. And, of course, people are frustrated with that. So there needs to be a concerted joint response to put this to an end.
Ebola cases had been leveling off in recent months, had appeared to be anyway. And then the head of the WHO recently said that these attacks will give Ebola force again and more people will die as a consequence. I mean, how worried are you that the insecurity will not improve and will lead to a surge in Ebola?
Right now, in around Beni, we've seen it calm down considerably. And what we're seeing on the ground is a response that has continued. There were interruptions, and that probably will result in additional cases. We'll know more, I would say, in about a week. But I think what's also important to note that the epidemic and the response has evolved considerably. And what's good in all of this is that the chains of transmissions are much better known. And that way it's easier to do the detective work to identify contacts that need to be monitored, vaccinated, perhaps isolated if they show the symptoms of Ebola. So I remain optimistic. We need to overcome the security challenges, but the people on the ground that have stayed are helping us see this thing through, and I think we'll be able to continue the progress that we saw in recent months.
David Gressley is United Nations Ebola Response Coordinator in the DRC. He's been speaking with us from Goma. David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was a big match this past weekend for you fans of soccer or football if you're from anywhere else on the planet. Manchester City took down Arsenal, but the big story was that the game was pulled from Chinese state television because Arsenal's Mesut Ozil had tweeted criticism of China's treatment of Muslim Uyghurs. Human rights groups estimate that 1 million Uyghurs are being detained unlawfully in Western China. The story, sports figures tweeting political opinion about China, may sound familiar to basketball fans. Not so long ago, the general manager of the Houston Rockets tweeted support for Hong Kong protesters and also faced backlash. Jeremy Goldcorn follows all of this. He's the editor-in-chief of Sup China News and co-host of the Seneca podcast.
So far, it seems that the backlash is less intense. And I would attribute this to the fact that it's much more difficult to find a target to focus your rage on in this case, because instead of a single American team, the Houston Rockets, at a time when there's a great deal of tension between the United States and China, instead of that, you have a Turkish-German player in an English league. Who exactly are you going to boycott? Is it Arsenal? Is it the Premier League? Is it all European football? So perhaps that's got something to do with it.
Ozil's team, Arsenal, they were very quick to say that his comments were his personal beliefs, did not represent the team, which kind of seems to be the common response when incidents like this happen. Explain the calculus here on the part of Arsenal.
Arsenal has a big business. They have a lot of fans. Their matches are watched by hundreds of millions of people. They sell merchandise. So just like the NBA, they see a threat to their business, and they made an immediate statement. They didn't at least go to the extent of condemning him, but they sort of left him, you know, hanging dry. They certainly didn't stand up for any principles, but that perhaps is a little too much to expect.
And that calculus isn't unique to sports teams in China, right?
One story our website recently did was a compilation of all the foreign companies that have had to apologize to China or change their websites or do something because they have annoyed the Chinese government, or when the Chinese government's favorite terminology hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. So this is a very common issue for companies that have business in China. If you publicly are caught saying something that in the Chinese context is politically incorrect or, you know, unacceptable to the Communist Party, there will be business consequences. So companies proactively censor. It is a matter of great concern to any company.
How big is the market for soccer in China, and how does that compare to NBA basketball?
Both are enormous. It's difficult to know the exact numbers, but you tend to see around 500 million people for NBA and north of 500 million people for soccer. Soccer happens to be a sport that Xi Jinping has publicly expressed support for, and there's an idea that one of his aims is to have China win the World Cup.
So, Jeremy, we've now seen China establishing this pattern. These sports franchises from abroad, adored in China, they have one voice that speaks its mind. China doesn't like what they hear and then censors the team's game. How long can they keep doing this?
That's a great question. You know, at some point, you've got to wonder, is there going to be any foreign sport left to watch at all on Chinese TV? This, I think, is something we're going to face in the coming decade. And it's one of many, many types of conflicts that the world is going to be having with China, where the Chinese government doesn't like the way the rest of the world tells a certain story. And this is going to have consequences for businesses, for diplomacy, for everybody. We won't really be able to get away from the sensitivities of the Chinese Communist Party.
Jeremy Goldkorn, editor-in-chief of SubChina News and co-host of the Seneca podcast. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Marco.
The war in Afghanistan has been grinding on for 18 years, and during that time, Afghans have tried bravely to go about life with a sense of normalcy. In a town just north of Kabul, 1,200 boys go to school, just trying to get an education, even though the school itself sits on the front lines of battle. The BBC's Aulia Atrafi visited the school and brings us this report.
Before the lessons begin each day, the army, who have a base next door, drive an armored Humvee vehicle into the schoolyard to protect the staff and pupils while they sing the national anthem. That's because the school is sitting close to the front line between the Taliban and the Afghan government forces.
Number four, the boy is 10.
An English lesson at the school. But even when the students are in the classrooms, they are not safe. With the Taliban firing rockets at the government troops, who respond with tank fire. The head teacher is Muhammad Ayub Safi.
Our students come here from across the area. And while no one targets them on purpose, they do get caught in the crossfire. Over the last 20 years, around 50 students and 12 teachers have been killed or injured.
Year 11 pupil Yarmal Danish wrote this poem after one of his friends was killed by a stray bullet.
Our friend Qasim Ibrahimi was killed. We began hating everything about the school and decided not to come here anymore. But our parents and siblings persuaded us to come back.
Zarmal's father is Bakhtullah Amiri.
Despite all the dangers, I send my son to school so that he studies and gains an education, because my generation have been deprived of knowledge and culture. I don't want my son to suffer the same fate.
Several of Ziarmal's classmates, including Niaz Muhammad, live on the Taliban side of the front line.
When I leave my house in the morning, I first greet the Taliban. Then, when I cross to the government side, I greet the soldiers. Sometimes they start fighting each other and we get caught in the crossfire.
Both Taliban and government combatants send their children to the school, but their boys face each other in a much more peaceful way on the cricket field. And as this student, Din Muhammad, explains, despite all the violence, they have not given up hope.
Education is very important. It can make our lives. If we study, peace and security will fall into place.
Life at school for one group of Afghan boys, the BBC's Aulia Atrafi reporting there from Kapisa province in Afghanistan. And that's our show this Monday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.